Hello, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Hogan. Really nice to be all with you all today. I'm a newly ordained novice at Bread Loaf, and this is only my second Dharma reflection. And since my first one was more of a spiritual autobiography, this is kind of my first actual Dharma reflection. So for my first theme, it seemed only fitting for me to start at the beginning, the most fundamental theme in what the Buddha taught, the Four Noble Truths. So, as I was trying to write this talk, I had to overcome all this shame and embarrassment, like, oh my goodness, everyone in this Zoom and probably the entire world has heard of the Four Noble Truths. You know, am I really going to be able to add anything to this? It felt like trying to sing a good cover version of a classic song that can't be improved upon. Like, does the world really need another version of Bridge Over Troubled Water? So I was imagining the worst, just assuming that everyone would be inwardly groaning when I announced the theme. And before I even started writing, I downed half a bag of potato chips, followed by a couple of vegan marshmallows. Dandies, I highly recommend them, better than regular marshmallows, and washed it down with some Tate's gluten-free chocolate chip cookies. And I don't know if you noticed, but right there, I've already got Noble Truths 1 and 2 covered. So the first Noble Truth is often expressed as something like, life is suffering. And you know, one can only assume that with advertising like this, it's no wonder that Zen centers aren't having to hold the doors against the rushing onslaught of eager practitioners excited to hear more about how life is suffering. But the word that's often translated as suffering is actually the Pali word dukkha, which has endured many attempts at translation. And for this talk, I was doing a little search on the various translations. So, aside from suffering, I found a ton of different adjectives in English that people have used to try to get at the concept of dukkha. Unsatisfactoriness is the most common one that I saw, but I've also heard stress, unhappiness, anxiety, unpleasantness, pain, uneasiness, worry, despair, irritation, dread, and many others. And personally, I think it feels a bit bleak to say that life is dread. And to be honest, even saying that life is unsatisfactory doesn't feel quite on the nose either. I mean, sometimes it is very unsatisfactory. And at other times, everything's going just the way you want it. You're spending time with the people that you love, spring flowers are blooming, everything's right with the world. Life feels thoroughly satisfactory. So one of the best explanations of dukkha that I've heard comes from Lee Brazington. And he was trying to capture how dukkha not only includes suffering, but all the small irritations and annoyances of life that keep us from getting what we want. So he gives two possible examples of dukkha. Having the flu is dukkha, losing your sunglasses is dukkha. And then he tries plugging in various words to see how well they work. So, losing your sunglasses is suffering, feels a little over the top. Losing your sunglasses is unsatisfactory, sounds a little mechanical. And eventually, he settles on losing your sunglasses is a bummer, which works so well. You know, having the flu, also a bummer. And he tries out a few other uses of the word dukkha. I teach only bummers and the end of bummers. May you be free from bummers and the causes of bummers. And he plugs it into one of the original discourses where the Buddha speaks about the First Noble Truth in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. Now, this bhikkhus is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is a bummer. Aging is a bummer. Illness is a bummer. Death is a bummer. Grief, lamentation, bodily pain, mental pain, and despair are bummers. Having to associate with what is displeasing is a bummer. Separation from what is pleasing is a bummer. Not getting what one wants, that too is a bummer. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are all bummers. I think this works so well. It's brilliant. So his first version of the First Noble Truth is bummers happen. And I think this is a pretty solid description of the noble truth of dukkha, but it still doesn't quite resolve the point I was raising earlier about the idea of life being unsatisfactory. Because how can we reconcile that truth with the fact that a lot of the time life can be really beautiful and enjoyable, and that the world is full of delightful things? It's not just one bummer after another. So this is where I thought that I would look into the etymology of the word. And apparently in ancient times, the ka in dukkha refers to a hole. Specifically, it's the axle hole of an ox-drawn cart, which is the kind that the ancient Aryans like to ride in, apparently. And su and du are prefixes that indicate good or bad. So sukha, which means happiness, breaks down to mean a good hole. And so dukkha is a bad hole. So basically, if the axle hole of the cart that you're riding in is bad, maybe it's got some dirt or some pebbles in there, you're in for a bumpy ride. And I really like that as a version of the First Noble Truth, that life is a bumpy ride. It's up, it's down, maybe even a roller coaster sometimes. It's exciting, it's terrifying. I realize this is only like one step removed from saying that life is like a box of chocolates. But for me, it's exactly the unpredictable up, down nature of things that makes life so difficult sometimes. Just because you're on top of the world right now means nothing for the next minute. There are no guarantees. Change is inevitable. Loss is inevitable. In a world of dualities, pleasure and pain are inextricably bound up with one another. In fact, they can't even exist apart from one another. It doesn't even make sense, really, if you look closely to imagine one without the other. And this is why I wanted to give my first Dharma reflection on the Noble Truths, because even if it feels basic, like Buddhism 101, it's really hard to fully take it in. You know, it makes me think about the psychological concept of each of us being made up of various parts from the psychological internal family systems approach. Sometimes ideas take a while to trickle down to the various parts within us. And for me, it's pretty clear that not all of my parts are on board with the Four Noble Truths. So many of my parts are totally on board with the inherent up, down, bumpy ride, bummer nature of life. But some parts have not gotten the memo, like the parts that encouraged me to first eat a bunch of potato chips before I was able to start writing the talk. Clearly, some part of me is convinced that although life might be hard, potato chips aren't going to help. So when the going gets tough, the tough get potato chips. And that segues pretty nicely for me into the second noble truth, samudaya, which means arising, or actually together arising. And often the second noble truth is understood as something like desire is the root of all suffering, or suffering comes from desire. Or as Lee Brazington puts it, bummers arise dependent on craving. And the word for craving is tanha, which translates to thirst. And some scholars point to the intertwined nature of dukkha and tanha. It's not so much that craving or thirst or clinging appears first and then causes suffering. It's more that craving and suffering come into existence together. The arising of one is in effect the arising of the other. And just like suffering can feel a bit overwrought to capture the full spectrum of what dukkha means, I think craving has a similar aspect. Yes, it can mean what we usually refer to as craving, reaching for another cookie, craving a drink, craving attention. But I'm also reminded of a part in the book, Being Upright by Reb Anderson, which I think some of you have probably read in preparing to receive the precepts. And in that book, there's a part where he speaks about spending a week in his hometown in the middle of glorious fall color. And on his last day of the visit, the sky was cloudy. And he thought to himself, this is nice, but it would be even nicer if it were sunny today. And then in the book, he says something like, and right there, I broke the precepts. And I can't remember which precept he was referring to, but it really stuck with me because on the one hand, it feels like, whoa, that's kind of intense. Just wishing for sun on a cloudy day, it seems pretty understandable, especially for me, since I'm speaking to you from the famously sunny city of Seattle. But on the other hand, yes, it's right there where dukkha sneaks in. The moment that the tanha, the thirst arises for just a little more sun so that we can really see the fall leaves in all of their red, gold, orange, brown glory, right there, dukkha is there too. Wishing for things to be different from how they are, how many millions of stories are based on that experience? If only he had stayed, if I hadn't gone that day, if she still loved me, if more people had voted, if that person had never been born, if I had hit the brakes in time, if she hadn't been caught out in the rain that night, if he hadn't gotten that blood transfusion, if I had never met you. These are the moments where the heart breaks. How much poignancy and love and loss and joy and regret and bittersweet memory is tied up with our need for things to not be the way that they always inevitably are. It reminds me of the five remembrances that I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. It's dark. But there's also joy in it. Whenever I speak those, they have the ring of truth to me. Like, yes, yes, this is true. This is real. Everything and everyone that I love will be taken from me. What is it to really look at that, to sit in that knowledge, to move and live from that place? For me, there's real freedom and real joy in it when you look closely enough. And this is what the third noble truth teaches us, Nirodha, cessation. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it's an ancient, some of you maybe have studied them, it's an ancient guide to meditation and union with the divine within Hinduism. There's a famous line, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. It's basically the definition of yoga, which means union with the divine, as what happens when the vritti of the citta, vritti being fluctuations or waves and citta being the mind. So when the waves of the mind are controlled or restrained, nirodha. And I haven't seen anything linking these two really significant uses of the word nirodha in Buddhism, in the Third Noble Truth, and in Hinduism, in the Yoga Sutras, but it seems clear that they're referring to the same thing. If the second noble truth, samudaya, the co-arising of thirst and suffering, tanha and dukkha, then the third noble truth refers to their restraint, their cessation. I teach only bummers and the end of bummers. Nirodha is the hope that we don't have to stay on the merry-go-round. My husband and I started calling the various merry-go-rounds or dukkhas of the world, we started calling them Ferris wheels. There was a time early in our relationship where he proposed the idea of going on the Ferris wheel in National Harbor. This was when we were living in DC. And I had never been to National Harbor. It's kind of a touristy, resorty spot. maybe half an hour out of DC. So I was like, sure, yeah, it sounds fun. So we drove there and we got there, and there were people everywhere, kids screaming at their parents, parents screaming at their kids. I remember huddling in a Starbucks, just trying to hide from all the commotion, and it was middle of winter, it was freezing. And we finally kind of made our way to the Ferris wheel, and the view was beautiful, but the little pod that we were in was blasting this just terrible pop music, and there was no way to turn it off. And so since then, we've started calling things Ferris wheels when, the things that are, they seem like they're supposed to be fun, something you should look forward to, structure your life around, but then turn out to ultimately be a disappointment, not really a lasting source of contentment, not really a lasting refuge. So basically, almost everything. Valentine's Day is a Ferris wheel. Going out for drinks is a Ferris wheel. Going to Disneyland is a Ferris wheel. And as I was writing this, I asked my husband about Ferris wheels and how he would define it. And he said that the thing that really defines the Ferris wheel for him is something that's reminiscent of something you experienced in the past, maybe as a kid that you really enjoyed. But and you're chasing that feeling, but it's something that you're never going to find out in the world. It's within yourself, but you're looking for it out there. Sorry, I lost my headphones. So it's very individual. Playing a board game could be a Ferris wheel, or traveling abroad, or watching movies. It's not so much the thing itself, but the motivation behind it, chasing something first. And to me, Nirodha, cessation, is the hope that the Ferris wheel can stop, that I can get out of the little pod. I can stop going in circles. I don't have to drive 45 minutes to National Harbor. I can be happy right here where I am. I don't have to avoid the bad feelings in my heart mind by just switching on Netflix. I don't have to drown my anxiety in gluten-free chocolate chip cookies. I don't have to wait for the next Wordle or Sudoku. I can really look at my life and accept everything exactly as it is. And I don't know about all of you, but I'm not there yet for sure, as evidenced by the aforementioned cookies. And sometimes the going looks really rough, like I'm not sure how I'll ever get there. And that's why we have the fourth and last noble truth, Magga, or path. So, number one, bummers exist. Number two, bummers arise dependent on craving. Number three, with the cessation of craving comes the cessation of bummers. And the best for last, the noble eightfold path leads to the cessation of bummers. Now, I always thought that the four noble truths were a little sneaky because you've got the first three, okay, and then the fourth one is actually eight all in one, right? It's the eightfold path. So it's like a little Matryoshka doll. And for me, the first two truths, the existence of unsatisfactoriness and the co-arising of that with craving, it's pretty easy to see in my own life. The Buddha is often called the great healer or the great physician, and the four noble truths track a medical model pretty closely. The first noble truth is the diagnosis of the disease, dukkha. The second is the etiology of the disease, the cause, tanha. But then in the third noble truth, we jump straight to the cure, nirodha. And we don't find out how to implement the cure until the fourth noble truth, magga, the treatment. So Norman Fisher points out the counterintuitive nature of the noble truths in his essay about Buddha as the great physician. He notes that we would normally expect a different order of things from a doctor: diagnosis, cause, treatment, cure. And yet the Buddha changes up the order and leaves us with path, the Noble Eightfold Path. So in this way, he's pointing to the fact that the path is ongoing. It's the circle of the way, the delight and the ongoing dance, as Norman puts it. So what is that ongoing dance? What is the Eightfold Path that leads to truth, or that in itself is truth, that embodies practice realization, as Dogen says? Right understanding or view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right meditation, right concentration. No big deal. The topic of another talk, but it's worth noting that these eight practices can be divided up into three sections. So there's the set of them that comprise right conduct or morality, right action in the world. So, and this is known as sila. It's right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Then there's right mental discipline or samadhi, which includes right effort, right meditation, and right concentration. And finally, there's wisdom, prajna, which includes right understanding or view and right thought. So together, sila, samadhi, and prajna are known as the threefold training, and their components are the Eightfold Path. But to step back from memorizing lists of things for a moment, sometimes it feels to me like to be a good Buddhist, you have to be good at memorizing lists. Three tenets, Eightfold Path, Threefold Training, Four Noble Truths. But for me, I am really grateful for this chance to look closely at the Four Noble Truths again, because it reminded me that everything I'm working on in the spiritual path is right there. There's no lasting happiness to be found in the world of dualities. That's dukkha, where I always want things to be different from how they are. That's tanha. But there is a path to getting off the Ferris wheel and instead embracing that childlike joy that Ferris wheels represent in the place where that joy actually lives, which is in my own heart. And I can remember that, maybe most importantly, all of us are together walking that circle of the way in whatever circumstances we may find ourselves. Whether we're practicing or not practicing, we are all walking as ourselves toward ourselves, towards our aging, towards our death, our loss, towards standing on the ground of our actions, and towards the joy of autumn leaves on a cloudy day. So, thank you.